He's just a fat old man rotting away in a Colorado prison. Terrified that he's going to die behind concrete walls, steel bars, and concertina razor wire, he spends his days filing appeals and writs in a never-ending stream of bullshit and lies. But he'll die in prison. If not that one, then another, or another. They're lined up like graves in a cemetery waiting on his mortal remains. And there'd probably be others if someone wanted to make him pay for all the death, despair, and ruin he caused. Just a bald, evil troll waiting for the end. But back in the day, he'd been a charmer, with his blue eyes and that soft South Texas drawl. Not particularly handsome, and already losing his hair by his 30s. But boy, could he spin a tale. The Good Samaritan who'd offer to help with a flat tire, or clear some brush, or fix a problem. Or just tell a good yarn about the places he'd been, the things he'd done. A smooth-talking son of a bitch. A real lady killer. Napa, California, July 10, 1974. On a summer evening when the Napa Valley was baking like a brick oven, Anita Andrews parked her tan 1967 Cadillac in front of the old three-story building that housed the bar she and her sister had inherited from their father 5 years earlier. She then unlocked the padlock and turned on the red and white neon sign that hung above the front doors, the signal to her patrons that tonight Fajani's Cocktail Lounge was open for business. Not that she was happy to be there. A former county fair beauty queen, the 51-year-old Andrews didn't like working at the bar. She already had a full-time job as a secretary at the Napa State Hospital, a psychiatric facility that included housing for the criminally insane. But long hours there weren't the reason she dreaded going to Fajani's as her second job. Although she'd practically been raised in the bar and had many fond memories of her father from the place, she told friends that she hated going there now. It was in a bad area of town and not a nice place to hang out anymore, at least not for a woman. That stretch of Main Street near the Napa River was a motley collection of dive bars, mostly serving the same barflies, assorted drifters, and outpatients from the psych ward who lived in the seedy hotel opposite the bar. Such was Andrew's distaste for Fajani's that she and her sister Muriel Fajani opened the padlock and turned on the sign, complete with a bright white neon martini glass on top, only enough to maintain its liquor license, which stipulated they had to operate 24 hours a week. They intended to sell the lounge, and the license would be needed to lure a prospective buyer. In the meantime, they took turns working behind the bar pouring drinks, listening to hard luck stories, and hoping for somebody with enough cash and the desire to take it off their hands. They were still waiting on that hot night in July 1974. Someday that neighborhood would change again, get nicer. But back then, Napa and the valley from which it took its name wasn't the pricey wine tourist destination and playground for the wealthy from the Bay Area it would become in the next decade. With a population just shy of 34,000 souls, the town was still just a sleepy little county seat 50 miles north of San Francisco, surrounded by gently rolling hills and a bucolic patchwork of farms, pastures, and the vineyards for which it had been known for more than 100 years. Once a jump-off point for silver miners, and known in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as having more bordellos than any other city its size in California, it was no great wonder that the town's first official business was a saloon on the corner of 3rd Street, down by the river. Nicola Fajani opened his tavern about 100 years later. A native of Italy, Fajani had immigrated to the Napa Valley, where he'd acquired a vineyard and winery. He'd sold that and purchased the old stone building on Main Street that had once housed a speakeasy during Prohibition and opened his own place. Back then, Papa's Bar, as his daughters called it, was a bar where a working man could bring his family for dinner, drinks, and camaraderie. Nicola was the cook and head bartender while his daughters hung out and played with the kids of his customers. The family was staunchly Catholic and conservative. His daughters weren't allowed to wear pants, only dresses. They were both beautiful young women, which was acknowledged publicly when Anita was crowned queen of the Napa County Fair in 1940. "I'm more than happy to have the honor, but a little sorry that Joan didn't win," the 17-year-old modestly told a reporter for the Napa Valley Register, referring to runner-up Joan Hofaker. Anita graduated from Armstrong's Business School in Berkeley. Then 2 years later, in June 1942, she married Clarence Mike Andrews, Jr. The couple moved to Berkeley and had two daughters, first Diana, then 8 years later, Donna. However, the marriage didn't last, and the couple divorced in 1951. A few years later, Andrews moved with her daughters back to Napa. She was a single mother, which was unusual for those times, but she worked hard and emphasized the need to get a good education to her daughters. Time passed. Her daughters grew up and moved out and onto their own lives. She remained close to her father, and the two often attended boxing matches and watched football together. When he died, she and Muriel, a former schoolteacher who moved back to Napa from Sacramento, inherited the bar. They had to work it themselves because it didn't bring in enough money to hire someone else. Everyone in town knew Anita Andrews and her tan Cadillac. She never remarried, but she had many longtime friends, like Joseph Silva, who'd lived next door to her on Main Street until he bought a home in 1973 and she moved to a new apartment on Soskal Avenue. He'd owned his own tan Cadillac, but his was a 52. When they were neighbors, they'd get together for coffee on some mornings or just sit on the front porch chatting. She was outgoing and warm, and he enjoyed her company. They'd even made plans to go out to dinner the night before, but she called to ask for a rain check. Sometimes when they talked, though, she told him she didn't like working at the bar. It scared her. One night she'd even called him up and quietly told him, "I got some creep in here. Would you call me back and pretend you're my boyfriend so I can get rid of him?" Anita had an on-again, off-again boyfriend, a mechanic for a carnival who was always on the road. But sometimes, when he was in town, she'd let him drive her car. Even the police looked out for Anita. There were no set hours for Fajani's, but as part of his late-night patrol down Main Street, the officer on duty would slow down as he passed the bar. If the padlock was off and the Cadillac parked out front, Fajani's was open for business. If the Cadillac was gone, he'd shine his spotlight on the padlock to make sure the place was secured before driving on. The evening of July 10th began like any other night at Fajani's. Only a handful of people had stopped in. By late evening, the only customers were three locals drinking at one table, a female work colleague from the hospital where Andrews worked, and a man sitting at the end of the bar smoking cigarettes, cutting a pack of cards, and flirting with Andrews. A drifter, by all appearances, he seemed to be a real smooth talker, judging by Anita's reactions. Eventually, her co-worker and the three locals left. Only Andrews and the man at the bar remained. The night, however, did not end like any other. For one thing, the usual police drive-by didn't happen. Otherwise, the officer would have noticed that the Cadillac was gone, but the doors weren't padlocked. Still, it wasn't until the next morning when Muriel Fajani received a call from the Napa Valley Hospital that the horrible truth began to make itself known. The caller said that her sister hadn't reported to work or phoned in sick. Muriel Fajani was puzzled. That wasn't like Anita, who was always punctual and never missed work without letting somebody know why. She drove over to her sister's apartment, but the Cadillac was missing and no one was home. She then decided to check the bar. When she arrived, Muriel saw that the front door was open, which she thought was odd. But the two swinging doors that led to the storeroom and were normally always open were closed. She pushed through them and discovered why. The half-naked body of her sister lay on the floor in a pool of blood.